Welcome to Ankh Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Ankh Live On Air is a podcast from Ankh Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Ankh Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Ankh Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Brooklyn, New York for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal cancer. At the meeting, faculty from Weill Cornell Medical Center and Montefiore Medical Center discussed the importance of next-generation sequencing in advanced gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancer and explained that a deeper understanding of the biology of neuroendocrine tumors may be key in propelling therapeutic progress forward. Faculty also provided insight into advances made in the treatment of patients with pancreatic cancer, outlined the next steps for research in that space, and shed light on some of the sequencing challenges created by the rapid progress made in hepatocellular carcinoma. Moreover, faculty highlighted how genetic testing is guiding treatment decisions in metastatic colorectal cancer, the novel strategies that are moving through the pipeline, and additional targets of interest in the space. First, we sat down with the chair of the meeting, Manish A. Shah, MD, FASCO, who was the Bartlett Family Associate Professor in Gastrointestinal Oncology, Director of the Gastrointestinal Oncology Program, and Associate Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. Shah, also Chief of Solid Tumor Service, Co-Director of the Center for Advanced Digestive Disease, an associate attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, told us that next-generation sequencing has become an important component in the management of patients with gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancer, as it has opened the door to several approved and investigational targeted and immune-based therapies. Listen on to hear Shah discuss ongoing research efforts evaluating immunotherapy and other novel treatments in advanced gastric and gastroesophageal cancer.
Sequencing is quite important. So in gastric and esophageal cancers, like many cancers, we really look to identify targets. So one of the key aspects, a key target that we need to identify early on is overexpression or amplification of HER2. And that's based on a TOGA study that led to the first approval of trastuzumab in gastric cancer. We do sequencing to look for tumor mutation burden and identification of any other potential targets that we might be able to exploit. One of the main areas of investigation is how to improve on immunotherapy. So we know that immunotherapy works in some patients with gastric and GE junction tumors, limited to tumors that overexpress or actually are positive for PD-L1. And we know that high expression of PD-L1 may increase the chance of responding. But even so, the chance of benefit, if you're PD-L1 positive, is only maybe 10 to 15%. So there's a lot of research trying to improve on that. There was a recent study looking at immunotherapy versus chemotherapy, and we see that chemotherapy is important early on where patients have advanced disease and they may be symptomatic, but over time immunotherapy can actually maybe help more patients. So one study that we actually have is to evaluate a short course of chemotherapy with immunotherapy, so we avoid any myelosuppression that might happen from long-standing chemotherapy and allow the immunotherapy to still work over time. And then as part of that study, we're also evaluating the role of radiation to see if we can even further stimulate an immune response to immunotherapy. So that's one area. Another area of investigation is also in terms of how to, another way to stimulate an immune response is we have a clinical trial where we're injecting an oncovirus into a tumor. So these are viruses that are only able to grow in the tumors, and they're driven by factors that the tumors make. So if the concept is that if you basically create a viral infection in the tumor, that can lead to some viral cell death, which is also very immunogenic. So that may actually help the immune system response. So most of the research that we have ongoing is on how to augment an immune response.
Next, we spoke with Lakshmi N. Rajev, MD, who said that as a greater understanding of the biological differences across neuroendocrine tumor subtypes is observed, other therapeutic strategies beyond somatostatin analogs are coming to the forefront. In our interview, Rajev, an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Montefiore Medical Center, discussed classifying and grading neuroendocrine tumors, navigating the current treatment approaches used to treat patients with these tumors, and novel therapeutic strategies in the pipeline.
Understanding the biology of the disease is important, and that's why the grading is important. The low-grade tumors, patients can live for, if you look at the SEER database, patients with carcinoid can do well for several years on an end. And it's important to understand when to initiate therapy. On the other hand, if someone has more high-volume disease, is symptomatic, recognizing that patients such as these might actually benefit from early intervention. Also understanding the difference between neuroendocrine tumors and neuroendocrine carcinomas, and that there are differences in the management. Also, it's important to understand that there are management differences between pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors as well as carcinoids. So for instance, sunitinib has limited activity in patients with carcinoid. On the other hand, everolimus, somatostatin analogs, PRRT, seem to work fairly well in both pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors as well as in patients with carcinoids. So understanding some of these differences really are key, and I think that in a practice where physicians are seeing more common tumors such as breast, lung, colon, and neuroendocrine tumors being somewhat rare, I think that it's important to understand that there are differences in biology between these tumors and there's different approaches. And understanding the grading, recognizing that the grading is very important and symptom burden is also very important. Additionally, another point that I wanted to highlight is in patients with liver-limited disease. So carcinoid syndrome is seen more commonly in patients that have liver metastases, and this is more commonly observed in patients with midgut tumors. It's less frequent in patients with lung carcinoids. Liver-directed therapies are very important in the management of these patients. So if patients with liver metastases can be resected, I think that that would be a tremendous approach. On the other hand, there are numerous other approaches, such as chemoembolization, radioembolization, bland embolization, transarterial, so taste therapy, radiofrequency ablation. And it's really not been shown that one therapy or intervention is superior to the other. And I think understanding the type of disease and discussing with your interventional radiologist will sort of help optimize the approach to the management of these liver metastases. So I think that it really is a multidisciplinary field here.
When Allison Ocean, MD, stopped by, she shared that recent strides have been made in the treatment of patients with early or locally advanced pancreatic cancer, with the emergence of several novel strategies resulting in significant survival gains for patients. Listen on to hear Ocean, an associate professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine and an associate attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, discuss pivotal trials such as the PRODIGE 24 CCTG PA6 trial in pancreatic cancer, the need for genetic testing, and other research efforts focused on improving patient outcomes.
The PRODIGE trial was a pivotal phase 3 trial that looked at the comparison of two chemotherapy regimens, FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine, in the adjuvant treatment of pancreatic cancer. And the standard of care before this was gemcitabine alone or gemcitabine with capecitabine. And this trial showed very positive results in favor of FOLFIRINOX for adjuvant therapy. The median overall survival time in this trial was approaching almost 4+ years, which is incredible for this disease. This definitely was a game changer for patients with pancreatic cancer. We now have a treatment regimen that has been shown to extend life significantly. For patients who are able to get FOLFIRINOX in the adjuvant setting, it should be given because of the significant survival advantage. There have been some advancements in the detection or earlier detection of pancreatic cancer because we now know that about 1% of new onset diabetics have a risk factor of developing pancreatic cancer. So we are starting to look into that population of patients, diabetics, and those who are newly diagnosed with diabetes later in life. They have approximately 1% chance of developing pancreatic cancer, so that's a population that we can look into. In development is a blood test to look for pancreatic cancer, so at its earliest stage, and that's currently being developed and in trials. Also, there is a recent guideline changing recommendation that all patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer should have genetic testing done because we may be able to find a mutation in their germline or in their tumor that number one is actionable and could lead to different treatments, but also we want to uncover these mutations because of the family members of these patients. So we want to know if any patients potentially have mutations that predispose them to pancreatic cancer, and if so, we want their family members to be tested.
Afterward, Manuel Hidalgo Medina, MD, PhD, the Chief of the Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, and an Associate Professor of Interim Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, came by to discuss available treatments in advanced pancreatic cancer and borderline resectable disease. Listen on to hear Medina, who is also an assistant attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, discuss treatment considerations in the advanced setting, as well as the utility of microsatellite instability and germline testing.
The field is moving towards preoperative treatment. Classically, we have approached this disease. If you have resectable tumor, surgery followed by adjuvant chemotherapy, and to some extent that still can be considered standard of care. The issue is that many patients present with disease that is larger, or a little bit larger than what would be considered resectable. We call it borderline resectable. And in those patients, there is now, I think, clear consensus that preoperative chemotherapy plus minus radiation therapy is beneficial. It's likely that that approach is also beneficial in the patients who are really resectable with very small disease. And of course, in the group of patients who have locally advanced disease that they are not resectable at front, you don't have any other choice than to start with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So as chemotherapy becomes more effective, as radiation therapy becomes technically better, I think the field is going to be moving in that direction. But we still lack, you know, large randomized clinical trials to address that particular point. Patients should be tested for MSI, a diagnosis, because we can provide a PD-1 blockade for those patients. For those small indications that, or molecular subgroups, that there is very clear benefit of some treatments, like the NTRK fusions, patients likely should be tested as well. KRAS, to see if you have G12C mutations. And that will be more for clinical trials and for a standard of care. And now it's also recommended to do germline testing for DNA damage repair. Repeat testing, I don't think MSI and germline, you don't need to do it repeated, you can just do once. But at the time of progression, if you have the opportunity to re-biopsy the patient and sequence again, that's probably more a research question, but I think that could open also opportunities, not so much for a standard of care, but to select more appropriate clinical trials.
A slew of regulatory approvals for novel agents such as TKIs and checkpoint inhibitors has significantly advanced liver cancer treatment in recent years. However, with this rapid progress comes the challenge of learning how to best sequence these drugs in practice, said Andreas Kobich, MD, an associate attending physician at Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine. In our interview, Kobich shed light on some of the systemic therapies that are available in liver cancer and some of the practice-changing phase 3 trials that have read out in the space.
We've basically had two or three different classes of drugs that have been
come onto the scene in terms of management options for liver cancer. Sorafenib is the original drug in this group for liver cancer. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's an oral drug. It's a pill. And the other drugs in that class that have also found use in liver cancer are regorafenib, which is very similar to sorafenib, as well as cabozantinib, which is another oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Immunotherapy drugs have made it onto the market in HCC as well, and that's been very exciting for us. Nivolumab first, pembrolizumab second. Lastly, an antibody to VEGF, ramucirumab, which also is the most recent approval in liver cancer, in the second line treatment of liver cancer. Well, I think you probably have to combine REACH and REACH2, because the test drug is ramucirumab, which is the VEGF antibody. It's an antibody to VEGF 1-2-3. In the original REACH trial, there was a signal. It wasn't quite as impressive as the study designers had hoped, but one of the subgroup analyses showed that liver cancer patients with an AFP of 400 or above seemed to do better on that drug compared to placebo. So the second trial was designed. Dr. Zhu is the, Andrew Zhu led that study, and another almost 300 patients were enrolled and randomized to ramucirumab versus placebo. And the only patients enrolled were good patients with hepatocellular cancer with AFP of above 400. And there was a modest but statistically significant benefit in survival in that study. And the drug subsequently got approved in the second line setting. Use of a lot of these drugs is not completely established yet. I think we have questions about sequence in terms of what drugs to use first, what drugs to use second, and we're getting additional data in terms of combinations, immunotherapy drugs plus other agents, which in the early trials looks like it might be more active, but we're waiting for larger trials to make that really part of our practice. And the immunotherapy, the studies that have led to the approval of immunotherapy are fairly small trials, each in the order of 100, 150 patients, with a good safety signal, a side effect profile that was well known from melanoma trials, and some nice signs of activity. Again, a modest response rate, but some patients who do exceptionally well. So that's been encouraging for a lot of us.
Next, we sat down with Al B. Benson, MD, who told us that genetic testing is a critical component of sequencing treatment and maximizing survival in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. In our interview, Benson, a professor of medicine of hematology and oncology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, discussed personalized treatment strategies for patients with metastatic disease and shared his recommendations for performing genomic testing in practice.
I'm talking about what to do, what to think about initially when you meet a patient with metastatic colorectal cancer. And that could be in a situation where it's a synchronous metastasis or a metachronous metastasis. And important points to address include the concept of the continuum of care. So when you meet an individual with metastatic colorectal cancer, you need to think about the broad picture over time. And you need to have the maximum information from which you can construct at least an initial plan in terms of what you might propose during the course of a person's illness. So that means it's important not only to define the sites of disease, the person's performance status, as well, of course, the patient's own wishes and goals in terms of therapy. But also, critically important now, is to understand as much as possible as to the genomic characteristics of the tumor. So right up front, you should be testing for MSI, RAS mutation, NRAS, BRAF, and also for HER2. HER2 testing is reserved for individuals who have wild-type RAS tumors. And from there, you can at least begin to decide, does this patient fit a given subset which might guide therapy, at least down the line? Also, what's important to consider is, does the patient have potentially resectable and therefore possibly curative metastatic disease? In that situation, it's critically important to bring in a multidisciplinary team approach so that the surgeon and the radiologist, for example, can weigh in as to the potential resectability. At that point, it's important then to decide what is going to be your therapeutic strategy. For the person who presents with resectable disease, it's advisable to give a more limited course of neoadjuvant therapy, usually between 2 and 4 months. Number one, you don't really need shrinkage because the person's already resectable. Second, by giving the chemotherapy, you'll have a sense as to chemosensitivity, which may help you in future treatment planning. And also, the drugs we use are potentially toxic to the liver. So you want to limit complications with surgical resection. For example, in the most common situation, a resectable liver disease. In terms of the first approach with a chemotherapy platform, with NCCN guidelines, and I think reinforced by the NCI GI intergroup study 80405, we do continue to have choices of the chemotherapy platform, whether it's FOLFOX, CAPOX, or FOLFIRI, and then a consideration of what biologic you might add. So in the case of a RAS mutated person, you would consider bevacizumab. You would have a choice if a person is RAS wild type to consider the introduction of either cetuximab or panitumumab as your first approach.
When we spoke with Luke Dow, PhD, he explained that WNT could be a prime target and immune agonist in colorectal cancer, given that the protein is expressed in the majority of patients with the disease. However, investigators are still in the early stages of identifying and developing compounds with which to target mutations that activate the pathway. Listen on to hear Dow, an assistant professor of biochemistry and medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine, discuss ongoing research evaluating WNT as a potential target in colorectal cancer.
At the moment, we have phase one trials for WNT-targeted therapies, and there's good reason to believe that they'll be effective. Unlikely that they'll end up being used in isolation, most likely as combination therapies, and I think we'll do a lot of work in the preclinical space to try and define those combination therapies so we can streamline the clinical trials as soon as we have good active compounds that are safe to give patients. So there was a phase one trial that's no longer recruiting, that's closed, that used a porcupine inhibitor, so this blocks the release of a WNT ligand from the cells. That was specifically in colorectal cancers that have osbondin fusions, which rely on the WNT ligand, as well as BRAF mutations. And so they were combined with BRAF inhibitors as well as an EGFR inhibitor to try and block MAP kinase activation. There are two other trials now either open or actively recruiting using similar porcupine inhibitors, but these are early phase dose escalation trials to look at safety rather than efficacy initially. I think once safety is established, then it'll be likely that these are combined with existing therapies that we know target relevant pathways. We have reason to be hopeful about strategies to target the WNT pathway, but we need to pay close attention to the types of mutations that activate the WNT pathway, as well as the other cancer-associated mutations that occur in those cells, because they could impact the way the cell responds to suppressing Wnt. In least from our perspective, what we're doing is being guided by the clinic, trying to learn from the types of alterations that we see in the clinic through genomic profiling and other things, as well as try and learn from these early phase clinical trials what's working and what's not, to really narrow our focus to address the questions that should be most immediately clinically relevant. We're focused on trying to define which contexts from a genetic standpoint would be most susceptible to Wnt therapies and those that may show complete resistance to targeting those pathways, with the goal that once we do have good compounds to go into the clinic, we could define a patient subset that would be most likely to respond.
We closed out the night with Ryan B. Corcoran, MD, PhD, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and of Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. Corcoran shared that several late-stage therapies, including targeted agents and immunotherapies, are being evaluated for patients with relapsed refractory colorectal cancer who have progressed on first and second-line therapies. Listen on to hear Corcoran discuss emerging therapeutics for patients with relapsed refractory colorectal cancer.
Regorafenib is approved in the late-line setting after a failure of standard chemotherapy, and it was shown in a trial compared to a placebo to extend overall survival by about 2 months. And so this is an agent that can be used at any point late in therapy. There are at times some toxicities associated with regorafenib, and there have been some alternative dosing strategies looked at. So one of the trials we'll talk about today is the REDOSE study, where they looked at standard dose of regorafenib, where you start at 160 milligrams, versus an escalating dose strategy, where you start at a lower dose and then escalate up in increments over the course of the next couple weeks till you get to a maximum dose, assuming it's tolerated. And this regimen was found to actually be slightly better tolerated and as effective. So that is a good option that can help with some of the potential toxicities associated with the agent. Immunotherapy has had a dramatic effect in a lot of different cancer types. One of the special things that immunotherapy brings is that many of these responses actually can be durable and much more durable than some of our current therapies. Now, unfortunately, in colorectal cancer, the majority of patients unfortunately haven't responded very well to immune checkpoint inhibitors. That being said, there is a subset of cancers, about 4 to 5% of metastatic colorectal cancer, that harbors what we call microsatellite instability or mismatch repair deficiency. These cancers accumulate very high numbers of mutations due to this defect in DNA repair, and thus they have a lot of mutations that can be recognized by the immune system. And so in this population, there can be are very high response rates and very durable response rates to immune checkpoint inhibitors. Outside of that, we're still actually working very hard right now to figure out how to extend the benefit of immunotherapy to the 96% of colorectal cancer that is microsatellite stable. And that's been a very difficult challenge right now. There are a lot of clinical trials looking at what we can combine with checkpoint inhibitors to actually enhance the immunogenicity of cancers. These include things like radiation, targeted agents, and other immune agents, including bispecific antibodies that actually engage an antigen on the tumor cell surface and also engage the T cell and bring those agents together to engender an immune response. So a lot of studies going on, hopefully some very interesting data coming out in the next few months to years.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about cutting-edge treatments in breast cancer, consider registering for the March 30th State of the Science Summit in Brooklyn, New York. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer on April 21st in Tampa, Florida. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.